Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Project Egg Show. I'm your host, Ben Gothard, and today we have the honor of speaking with So-young Kong. How are you doing today, So-young?
Good. How are you, Ben? Great to
I
be on
am.
the show.
Oh, I'm so grateful that you would carve out time out of your busy schedule. I know you're doing like a billion and a half things that I'm so excited to chat about today. So thank you very much for carving out the time. I really wanted to ask you to kick it off. What is your story?
Great question. I guess I'm a serial entrepreneur. So I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur when I was 8 years old, but I didn't actually start my first company until about 10 years ago. So when I started my first company, I was at McKinsey actually in California. And then after leaving McKinsey, I kind of, I guess, discovered my life purpose and my mission. And that resulted in starting my first company, which is called Awaken Group. And it's a transformation design company. We integrate leadership, strategy, and human-centered design. And so after doing that, and that company's still around for about 10 years, then I spun out my second company, which is called Novi.
So that seems like kind of the short answer. I want to get into the details here. So
Sure.
at 8 years old, you knew you wanted to be an entrepreneur. How did you know, and what did that actually look like?
Well, I think, so I grew up in New York, and I guess what happens is that, I had grown up with skyscrapers all around me all the time, right? So I saw all of those skyscrapers, and I said, I want to work in one of those skyscrapers. And I'm 8 years old, right? So I pictured myself carrying this briefcase because that's what I had seen, and I had this vision that I was going up the elevator into the skyscraper, and I was walking into the corner office. So I assumed that it was my company, because I walked into this corner with my little 8-year-old self, and I had this like Windows corner office with a piano in there because I play the piano, and I didn't know what I was doing in that office, but I just always had this idea that I would be in there with my company, and so I guess that was this little image I had of myself when I was 8. But then I guess I became a mini or a micro entrepreneur when I was 11, because I started to teach piano when I was 11 years old. And that's actually how I made my way through junior high and high school. That was my, so I didn't have to ever babysit. I just taught piano, and I made more per hour doing that. So that was, I guess, the beginning of my entrepreneurial pursuits.
So did you see in a movie, or were you reading something, or did somebody talk to you about it? Like, why at 8 years old was that a dream of yours? Why were you picturing that in your head?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I guess it's a combination of a few factors. I guess one is I come from a family of entrepreneurs. So my father, my uncles, and a lot of people. So when my relatives immigrated from Korea, they became entrepreneurs. And so I guess I'm used to seeing a lot of entrepreneurs. That's probably a big factor. And I like to just create things. So, some kids are the ones who like to create. So ever since I was young, I was the one, I would invent games. I would invent things to do. So I'm very much a creator. I love to solve problems. So when I see them and I don't see a good solution, I just naturally will try to figure out a way to solve that problem. And I guess that's the some of the ingredients for becoming an entrepreneur, if you will.
What were some of the things that you invented when you were a kid?
Oh, all kinds of things. So in sixth grade, so for all of my friends who might be watching from elementary, we created our own sorority when we were 12 or 11 years old, based on a book. So it was a little girl sorority. We invented our own rules, our own code of conduct. We used to invent our own games, literal board games. And we would invent little businesses. So we just invented all kinds of things all the time for fun. And so back then we didn't have, mobile phones, and we didn't have a lot of digital tools and iPads. So we literally had pen and paper, and we would make our own stuff. And so I think that that was really cool, because as kids you just had a lot of creativity and the opportunity to exercise creativity. So I still encourage my friends with kids now to do that, and take away the technology and let people think and let kids think, because they'll just invent all kinds of stuff.
Right. So how did you what was the journey from then, creative inventor, until it seems like you ended up in corporate life and in the
I
corporate
did.
world for a while? What was that transition? How did that journey, or what did that journey look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I guess even though I had all of that kind of creative stuff going on, you know, I still had to get a real job or whatever that looks like. So I worked in Japan for a couple of years, teaching for a year, and then working for a convention bureau, which was also entrepreneurial. So I've always been at least an intrapreneur, if not, you know, I was always inventing new things within the companies that I worked for. So when I was in Japan, for example, at the convention bureau, I was an international coordinator. So I was doing sales and promotion for foreigners coming to do conventions in Japan. And so I would invent new ways of actually sharing the work of the convention bureau that they had never done before. And I would convince them on why that was important and using new technologies to actually promote this area. So then I came back to the US, to New York, which is where I'm from. And then I started working for Citigroup. And so when I worked for Citigroup, I took the job, actually, I had the opportunity to work for a PR company, Fleischmann Hillard, or to work for Citi. And Fleischmann Hillard would have been doing PR for financial services, which is interesting, you know, but the opportunity at Citi was very entrepreneurial. So the opportunity was to build the new Asian business for Citibank's first branch in New Jersey in Englewood. So at that time, Glass-Steagall had happened and Citibank had no branches in New Jersey because they were not able to have, you know, banks in the neighboring states. So the first bank that was opened after Glass-Steagall was Englewood. So I was hired there to literally build this new market because a lot of Japanese and Korean conglomerates have their headquarters actually in North New Jersey. Mm. So they're like, go after that business. So I knew nothing about banking. I had no connections to the Japanese and Korean business. I mean, I was born in, you know, DC and I grew up in New York, so I'm not even from Korea. I spoke a little Japanese because I had just come back from living there. I really knew nothing about business. I knew nothing about marketing. And I was like, oh, cool. I'd like to do that. And so I literally built this new business in like 6 to 12 months.
Wow. So was it the challenge? Was it like, oh, this is going to be fun. This is a challenge. Yeah. That's just calling my name. I have to do it.
Yeah, it was kind of like, I was like, oh, that sounds like a fun opportunity. So it was like these opportunity. One was like safe, you know, corporate, or one was, you know, a corporate like Citi, but it was the opportunity to build a new business. And so I was naturally drawn more towards, I guess, that challenge. And I honestly didn't know anything. So it was really, you know, picking up. At the time, we had this thing called the white pages before Google. And then the white pages was your business directory. And I literally flipped through and I just dialed for dollars. I would just call organizations and associations. I made flyers of myself with a picture and my phone number that you could tear off to if you wanted to open an account with me. So I did all kinds of really grassroots marketing because I just didn't really know better. But it worked. So within 6 months, you know, I was able to be the top salesperson in all of Tri-State New York. And so it's just one of those things where sometimes ignorance is really bliss. You don't know the best practices. So you just do what you think is intuitive. And I went to where my customers were. So the Japanese customers like to shop at Yaohan, the Japanese grocery store. And the Korean, you know, like to hang out in these type of shops. So I would go to those shops and put all my flyers up. And I look back on it now and I think, I don't think I would do that now, you know, because now I think I know better after my MBA, but maybe not. You know, maybe I knew much better when I was fresh out of college and willing to make tons and tons of mistakes.
I love that idea of doing what comes most naturally or what's most intuitive to you, because I feel like there is a huge, huge epidemic almost of people going on YouTube, copying what they see on some 30-minute video of like, okay, this is how you do it. And then everybody's just repeating what somebody on YouTube put there. And y'all, the YouTube video may not be right. Like, it may be wrong. It may be like bad advice.
Absolutely. And there's context, right? So everything requires context. And I think you're totally right, Ben. I think what I encourage people to do is to think for yourself. YouTube is great. And of course, I have Nobi, a learning platform. So I want people, I want everyone to learn on Nobi, right? But I still think that you need to learn and you need to think on your own. All of that is context and information to help us to make better informed
Well, folks, it looks like we're having some technical difficulties. This is the fun of doing things live. So I'm going to tell y'all a joke. And if you've been on the show, you know the joke. But for those new people, I want to share this joke with you. What cat do you never play cards with? I'm pausing to let you think. A cheetah. That's right. I love corny jokes. I can't help it. Okay, while we wait for Show Young to come back, I have another joke for you. If they're at, this is more of a question, and this one is really going to require you to think hard. If there is a house like this, for those on audio, a triangle top, then, oh, hey, So Young, welcome back. Hey, so what I like to do whenever there's, what I like to do whenever there's a live, like an interruption or technical difficulties live, I like to tell little riddles. So I'm right in the middle one. I just got to finish it real quick just so nobody's left with a cliffhanger. Okay, so
got it.
There's a triangle roof, okay? And if a rooster lays an egg right on the top, which way is the egg going to roll? Okay, think about it, y'all. I'm not going to tell you the answer. It's going to drive you nuts because you think you know, but I bet you don't know. But think about it. Okay, anyway, so Young, please continue with what you were saying.
Okay. I think my internet, I don't know why. I have all four bars up, but it still shows unstable. So I'm not sure why that's the case. So sorry about that.
All good. The show must go on.
Absolutely.
So yeah, please please continue with what you were saying. I believe the last thing I heard was you have a learning platform.
I think what I was talking about was this idea that you can watch a bunch of YouTube videos and, like you said, people just copy it, right, without thinking. And I totally agree with you. And in some ways, that's why when I created Nobi, I didn't want it to be just like that. Otherwise, why create it? You can just get YouTube, right? In some ways, it's YouTube 2.0, because I wanted people to watch that video and actually pause and think, what does that mean to me? How does it apply to my context? How would I apply that, given the fact that my context and situation might be different from the person who created that YouTube video? And then how do I share those learnings so that other people can learn from me and I can learn from them? And that's why when I created Nobi, it was very much about this idea of contextualizing content and developing those critical thinking and those creativity skills. Because all of us have it, but we've kind of become very lazy and very passive in our learning. And what I think is really dangerous is the perception of learning. So what happens now is we watch a bunch of videos and we think we're an expert in X topic, but we haven't critically analyzed it and critically thought about it. And I think that's really dangerous. And so in some small way, Nobi is actually trying to address that by causing people to think, to apply, and to share, not just to know stuff.
I think that's really powerful, because one thing that kind of dawned on me recently was, and I think I've always kind of done this intuitively, but like I was finally able to articulate it. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. But when we try something for the first time, and we just straight follow our gut, we don't listen to anybody else, we just do it our own way, we actually might, intuitively, we actually might be doing it in a way that is so far superior to anything that's ever been done before.
Absolutely.
So like, why would you copy somebody when you don't even know if your way, which is unique to you because it's your way, is better than anything else that's out there? That's my question.
Absolutely. And I think you're hitting it on the head, because I think there's also some confidence issues that sometimes people don't feel confident either to try and make a mistake, which is super fine, right? So it's a confidence that I think I do know, but I'm not confident if I can do it, or the fear of failure that if I try and it doesn't work, that I'll look stupid in the process, you know? And whenever you're learning anything, like I always give the example of, you know, learning how to ride a bike. When you learn how to ride a bike, you will fall. You might need training wheels in the beginning. You might be clumsy. You're not able to quite get it straight. You might be wobbly. And if you don't go through that wobbly period, no one just jumps on the bike and just goes, right, full on the moment they get on. So why is life any different? And so, you know, we give ourselves a break when we're learning how to ride a bike, but maybe we should give ourselves a break when learning a new skill and give ourselves the chance to unlearn, to make mistakes, to fall, to scrape our knee. And then that is part of the learning process, and embrace that. We've kind of forgotten sometimes like what learning is really about. And we just want to move like incrementally forward as like with no setbacks, but you can't learn without setbacks.
You're absolutely right. And I actually think that setbacks are helpful. And I know it sounds weird, but I think they're helpful because whatever we're trying to do, like that's life's way of saying, hey, that's not the best way to do it. Like,
absolutely.
Not this way. Try again. It's like in a video game when you fail a level, it's like, okay, go back, try it again, try something different. Mm-hmm. That's really helpful because imagine if you didn't get that feedback then and there. That is like direct feedback. Imagine if you didn't get that feedback and you went on for years continuing to make mistakes without realizing it. Yeah. At some point, the whole thing would implode because the foundation is weak. There is no like strength there.
No, you're totally right. And we know that when we play games and we accept it when we're kids, but somehow as we get older, we stop that. And so I think one part of what I'm passionate about is kind of raising human consciousness and helping people to have the courage to unlearn, to make mistakes, because that's when true learning and transformation takes place. And it's not a pretty journey of step, 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 step. It's actually step up, step back and learn, step forward, leap forward, take a step back, leap forward again. But the beautiful thing is that as we're taking this journey of learning, we are moving forward, but we're just not moving forward in a linear path. Life exactly. is not like that straight line graph. And so I think learning requires unlearning, especially as the older we get, the more we need to unlearn before we can learn because we think we know everything. And then, you know, that's why you say that wisdom comes from knowing that you don't know.
Right. That's exactly. And what's interesting that I found, and again, I'm really curious to know your experiences here, but I found like in the beginning, I might make rapid jumps and like I'll learn a lot very quickly. I'll make more like basic or simple mistakes in the beginning, but I'll improve very quickly. And then it's almost like there's this like plateau
yep.
for a little while. And there's just something there. Maybe there's skills I need to learn or some knowledge I need to bring, or like I'm just too close to it. I need to step back, whatever it is. But then it's like you plateau for a little while and then bam, one day you just, it's like a vertical straight up rocket. And then it's like, oh my God, everything just changed in like a day. But because you were grinding away for that, I don't want to say grind away at it, but like because you were working towards it that whole time and getting a little bit better, a little bit better, yeah. a little bit better,
yeah.
bam, that's what causes the big jump. Have you had that experience?
Oh, all the time. Absolutely. It's, you know, we call it the aha moments, right? Mm-hmm. And when you have those aha moments, they can be triggered by many different things. But it's true that, you know, you're kind of working at it and you're constantly developing. You're curious, you're open to actually new ways of thinking. And a lot of times it's a mindset shift. Really, you know, it's maybe a limiting belief we have. And sometimes we need to unlock that limiting belief about ourselves, about what we're capable of to actually allow us to jump and leapfrog to the next level. So absolutely. Sometimes it's mindset, sometimes it's beliefs, right? And sometimes it's just skills and knowledge. Knowledge is the easiest of all those things to obtain.
Totally. So I'm curious. I know I've said that a lot, but I actually am really curious.
I can tell. I can tell, Ben.
When you on your platform, as people are going about like consuming information, it seems like there's an engagement piece there, which is very critical to the platform
yeah.
to help people really process what they're learning, not passively just soak in a little bit, but like take more ownership of the information and really like cement it in there. What psychological principles or neurobiological processes or whatever, like what are you firing off in the brain to actually make that learning, that better learning happen?
Yeah, great question. So maybe I'll do some nerdy talk for a second.
Yes.
Yes. So basically, so people often talk about pedagogy, right? Which is actually the science of how children learn. Actually, adults learn differently. With adults, it's called andragogy. but many people don't talk about andragogical principles in adult learning. They talk about pedagogical principles for adult learning, which is not really quite accurate because adults learn differently. So in the science of adult learning, which there are maybe 30 years of research around, you know, how adults learn, and there's also something called humanagogy, which is the common principles of how humans learn. So there is an overlap between andragogy and pedagogy and gerontogogy, which is for seniors. But anyway, so humanagogy actually cuts across that. So I'll just talk about andragogy for a second. So in the andragogical research, the way that adults learn is based largely on Jack Mesereau's work on transformational learning. But also a lot of different adult psychologists who basically say that adults learn through context. So it has to be very contextual. The reason for that is we have a lot of life experiences. So as children, you don't have experiences. So you're able to learn remote, you wrote in a rote way because you're memorizing, because you don't actually have that many experiences to draw from. So you're able to just absorb like a sponge. And then you also have a lot more neuroplasticity, right? So you're able to just adapt. As adults, things are a little bit more firm. So we need context. So contextual-based learning is extremely important. And with adults, we have to participate and take greater ownership of that learning, much more so than children. Because for us, we have other experiences that have to be unlearned or reshaped or challenged. And then we also have to then discuss and debate in order for us to learn. And the process of discussion is a very critical part of challenging our thinking patterns, which have been a bit more, I would say solidified, in order to loosen some of those things, in order for those neurons to start firing again. And so we need to then, so just simply put, we need to both have context, have discussion, and have the ability to apply and take ownership of what we've learned. And if we don't do that very quickly, our retention rate goes down significantly. So at Nobi, we actually just synthesize all the nerdy research, because that's a bit much to remember, into what we call MPPG. MPPG, mobile first, participatory, personalized, and group-based.
That's
and
awesome.
That's just an articulation of the science, right? The neuroscience, behavior design, gamification principles that are all at work in order to drive and encourage participation, ownership, and application.
So let me make sure I understand. So pedagogy is how peda. Children, I'm sorry?
It's child.
Ah, pedagogy, okay. And then that's how children learn, and children will basically memorize things and they'll soak things up like a sponge because there aren't as many experiences in there to challenge the new information. So it's just accepted almost blindly, just accepted and yes. Soaked in. Then Andragogy is a man or a woman.
Mm-hmm. Andragogy okay. is the science of how adults learn.
Andragogy is how adults learn. And that is a little bit different because we already have a lot of those experiences. And so when new information comes in, it almost seems like it has to then challenge that existing information. So in order to accept the new information, we need to have context based on what we already know. We need to be able to apply it, and we need to be able to discuss it in order to really challenge those older beliefs. Am I understanding correctly?
Absolutely. I think you said it better than I did. Absolutely. That's exactly right. So you
That's
can
so
imagine. Yeah. So you can imagine, and it makes sense, right? As an adult, if someone says the sky is red, you're going to go, I don't think so. In my experiences, the sky was not red. And you will not just believe that the sky is red. You will have to figure out, why is it red? If it was red, was there some research? Was there some special thing that happened? Because in your context, in your mind, in your experiences, the sky has never been red.
Hmm. So is that why something like the Socratic method is really effective? Because we're talking about it, so that hits the discussion part. And then in the discussion, people are probably talking about it from their own context.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, I don't think that's as much as applying it, but I guess if you're discussing it and then you decide like, oh, okay, this makes more sense, I guess you're then going to try to apply it to your own life, at least intellectually, to reinforce it.
Yeah, and I often say that we apply the Socratic method to our platform. So Nobi is based on the Socratic method. And so if you're someone who wants to just watch videos and be more entertained, more the edutainment category, you may not actually like Nobi, because Nobi actually will ask you questions and get you to think and participate and engage in your learning experience. And for those who don't like that, they may prefer more edutainment, which is just watching a bunch of stuff passively and not truly engaging. But then if you actually were to test the effectiveness, retention, applicability, the ability to apply, you'll see that there'll be drastic differences in the different learning methods.
So question, I've noticed that, big surprise there, another question. I've noticed that a lot of people, and it kind of makes sense with what we're talking about, but like I've noticed, and this is just my experience, that as people get older, they're a little bit more set in their ways. Not all the time, of course. It's a generalization, but more often than not, I've found that this is true.
Yeah.
Right. So, but I've also noticed that people will get attached to a certain idea to the point where, and I do this too. So to the point where like we attach our identity to some belief or some piece of information or some idea. And so like a new idea, even if it totally factually contradicts this older idea, because we've attached our identity to it, like that new information, we interpreted that as we're being challenged, like our validity as human beings are being challenged. So how does that play into this learning style, this adult learning style? Like how does that fit in? And I'm interested from the actual, like the nerdy science part, because I'm a super nerd. I love nerds. I think that's like where the serious, like where we can make a lot of progress here is to understand it at that level.
Yeah, I think your question is probably much more complex, because you're talking kind of about beliefs and identity. So it goes, I think, below the surface of just learning. Mm. Because when your identity then becomes tied to your beliefs, that goes much deeper into questions about who am I? Why do I exist? So they get into much more, I would say, existential questions, versus the ability to separate your ideas and thoughts from your being. So I think your being and your knowing are related, of course, but I don't think that your being has to be predicated on your knowing, right? And so that's why when we talk about learning, for example, I would say that there's multiple levels of learning. There's a learn by knowing stuff, there's a learn by doing, there's learn by teaching, and then learn by being, you know? So if there's multiple levels of learning, if you will, I don't think they all are quite, they're related for sure, but I don't think it's kind of a foregone conclusion that if I know something and I believe it, then it actually affects my being if you disagree with me. Because if I'm able to respect, and that comes to values and other kinds of stuff. So if I value diversity of thought as a value, then even if you have a different point of view and a different belief than I do, then I will still choose to respect and value as a human, even though you and I have different beliefs on something.
That's fascinating. So are you tackling these sorts of levels of learning on the platform too? Like how's that being integrated?
Yeah. Yeah, we actually are. So learn by knowing is the basic level. And I would say most digital platforms focus on learn by knowing, right? In some ways, you can argue YouTube is learn by knowing. It's knowing stuff. It's content. And in most of the learning platforms are learn by knowing. The learn by doing bit is not as common, which is in pushing you to apply what you've learned. And so there are some apps that do that and platforms, which are that I think are they're just deeper from a learning experience, and we're passionate about that. Learn by teaching is a very, very big thing for us. So Nobify is actually our curation and authoring platform where anyone can create content, literally. And so we've had 8-year-old children Nobify content. And what's cool is that as they're teaching other people and creating the course, they're learning more. We have a group of high school students in Palo Alto who are going to Nobify content on sustainable development goals. And so as a result of doing that, I'm sure they're going to learn so much more about the SDG goals, because they're going to teach other people and create a course to teach others in our platform, than if they were to read a bunch of textbooks on it.
That's awesome.
A much higher level of knowledge, right? And then once you do all of that, I believe that will become part of their being, because that will be so embedded into their kind of consciousness. So I'm very excited, actually, you know, and whenever people create on our platform, we have people constantly creating in multiple languages. And it's super exciting to me because as they're creating, I know that they're deepening their experience and their being and their knowledge of those topic areas in a much more human way, in a much more holistic way than just reading textbooks or watching videos.
So based on my understanding of memory, I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I want to know the right information, not try to be right. So my understanding is we have our short-term memory and we have our long-term memory.
Yeah.
And if we want to remember like for a long time, then we need to move things from our short-term memory into our long-term memory. From my understanding, when we first learn something, it goes into our short-term memory, and a small percentage of that then goes into our long-term memory. And the way that we make it these memories more concrete in our long-term memory is to make that transfer from short-term to long-term over again and over again. So how, and I think I know the answer based on what we've talked about, but like, how does the platform utilize this principle of repetition to make these long-term memories more concrete?
Yeah. So have you heard of the Ebbinghaus forgetting curve?
No, but I need to check that out.
Yeah. So Ebbinghaus, I was just looking it up so I can speak correctly here. But basically it's called a forgetting curve, that they say that within 9 hours of learning something, you will have forgotten like 70%. Within a week, you forget like 90% of what you've learned. So that's kind of your short-term memory, because if it doesn't stick over to your long-term, it will just go away, right? Mm-hmm. And so the way that it actually shifts over to long-term is actually through what we just talked about. The adult learning principles of being able to apply, discuss, and take ownership increases the chance of it moving into long-term. Space repetition is one technique. There are many different techniques of moving things into long-term. The most powerful is actually doing and teaching. Once you do and teach, you're very rarely going to forget that, right? Because now it's part of your being. And once it becomes part of your being, that's a transformational shift. It hardly ever goes back, short of some traumatic experience, right? So the idea of those learning kind of levels I talked about deepen that actually and increase the chance of it moving into long-term. Right. So instead of talking about, you know, baseball, actually, that's a terrible example because I don't play baseball, like driving a car. Right. You learn how to drive a car, but you only can learn how to drive a car so much by watching a video. Or if you told me how to drive a car and explained it to me on a video, I could kind of get a sense of what it was, but I won't actually know how to drive a car unless I actually get in the car and do it myself. Now, I might still not understand the full mechanics of how the brakes and all that system works. But now if I had to teach you how to drive, then I will learn more about all the different elements. So my experience would go much deeper, right? And then if I'm able to then after a while of doing it, it just becomes so natural, becomes part of your being that you don't even think about all of the things about the headlights and the flat, you know, the blinking lights, you just do it. So that just becomes supernatural. And so when you're doing that, that's then part that's shifting, right? It's not a short-term memory, it's long-term because it's been practiced. So you can take very simple things and then apply that too. But then space repetition would be, I drive every day. If I don't drive every day, then I'll forget, right? Or I might not be as good or lose confidence over time. So then space repetition. So in our platform, we'll do reminders. We'll kind of ping you over time and say, it's been 3 days, it's been 4 days, come back, continue your learning. Or we'll say, hey, Ben, last week you said X, Y, and Z. It's been about a week. How do you think about that? How has your thinking evolved? And assume that you're actually building on that knowledge to actually increase your retention and understanding. And assuming that knowledge increases and changes over time.
That is so fascinating. So it seems like going through the steps and like going through those levels of learning, that is actually giving you the repetition that you need to both reach that fourth level of being and simultaneously bring it from short-term to long-term memory enough times, or having done enough repetitions to where it's there, and or at least it gives you the best chance of having it there concretely. And then it seems like the maintenance that you need is that space repetition of doing it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again on a pretty frequent basis.
Yeah, and it depends on the topic, right? So I think what I'm explaining to you is kind of the science and the research of it. And it depends on what you're learning. You know, some things are really kind of quick things. I need to understand this product. So I need to learn the features of this product so I can sell it better tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That's one kind of learning, right? There's another kind of learning is I want to do leadership development. I want to make myself a better leader and communicate better and be kinder and more grateful and more generous, you know, or whatever, right? That's one kind of learning. Another kind of learning is I need to learn these digital skills so that I can understand the APIs and technical skills. I can integrate that better, right? So depending on the type of thing you're learning, whether it's knowledge, skills, technical or soft skills, the andragogical approach you take might be different. And the way that you use spaced repetition or not might be different. So those are techniques, I would say, in order to help deepen the learning or experience. But there's also always going to be the room for the human curator, the human teacher, the human facilitator, who then designs it in such a way based on what they believe is the most impactful for their topic.
Hmm. So I'm curious, and maybe we could look at it from the lens of like your life's calling, right? Or your purpose. Sure. and really trying to be the very, very best at that thing in the whole wide world. Mm-hmm. And based on what I've read thus far, it seems like the 10,000 hour rule is like, that is the gold standard, right? Got to have 10,000 hours to master a skill and to be, you know, the super awesome best at that, or at least the best version of it that you can be. So how, first of all, is that scientifically accurate? And two, how do we integrate all the things that we've been talking about into this 10,000 hour rule, or maybe do it better than that, but in the same spirit of it, to truly master something and achieve our highest level and reach our highest level of potential within that thing that we're trying to do?
Yeah, no, great question. Whether it's scientifically accurate, I'm not sure. I think there are probably scientists who would say, no, it's not scientifically accurate, you know, because I think there's other factors involved with mastery of anything than just spending 10,000 hours on something. So for example, I mean, if I were to practice basketball for 10,000 hours, I don't think that I would be the best basketball player because I'm like 5'1". So I think that might be challenging. So I think there's definitely certain things that 10,000 hours may not help with. But that being said, I think the idea of investing time and energy on a knowledge, a mindset, skill that's more intellectual, you know, that's soft skills based. I do think obviously if you spend that much time and effort on something, you will get better at it, right? And so I think there's something very powerful there. And it's funny because one of the reasons why we track hours by skills and by category is actually based on this whole 10,000 hours, right? That actually it's a stronger indication of my interest in something. So if I'm looking at the future of work and 21st century skills. If I have two guys I'm gonna hire, one person has spent 1,000 hours on innovation and studying and learning innovation, and the other guy zero, and it's an innovation role, I might be more inclined to take this person if all else is equal, right? So I do think that it's a strong indication of passion or interest in something. I think only actual on the job stuff would show whether the application of that actually works, but it's definitely a strong indication. So in terms of, you know, like purpose and aligning all that to mastery, I think there's many things involved with that. Your natural talents, your strengths, and then your investments, right? The effort that you put in. And so I think once you're able to combine those things, that's a really powerful thing.
I think so too. So when we're in the process of practicing and training and learning and getting better at this thing.
Yeah.
So let's make it real. Let's have like an example. I'll use myself as a guinea pig. So let's say like interviewing, the skill of conducting an interview, right? Yeah. What is the difference in progression between me teaching it and doing it and learning about it? And then I don't know how to measure like being it, right? But like, I think you understand kind of the spirit of the question, like
Yeah.
Where should I invest my time to get the biggest result and to achieve mastery the most effectively? Not trying to take a shortcut, but just the shortest path from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in your case, Ben, you've clearly been doing it for a while, right? And you know about it. So for you, I think it depends on where the person is on their journey. So the next step for you would be to create a course, and you should notify a course on how to do interviews and how to do live interviews in the most successful way. And in so doing, you probably will increase your practice because you're going to realize there's certain principles that you've actually learned along the way that you may not even consistently apply, right? Mm-hmm. And then it actually will come back and be like, yeah, that's true. That is actually best practice. And then apply that. So in the course of teaching, you will probably improve yourself. And then as you're doing that over and over again, it already is part of your being because it's natural, right? So I do a lot of public speaking, right? And I don't really think about some of those steps anymore. Some of those things are intuitive, but I still find it valuable to go back and refresh my memory on those best practice tips or those principles and go, oh yeah, that's true. I stopped doing that recently. Let me go back to that. So, I mean, it's not really a linear process, but you're constantly going back and forth, relearning, but relearning in a different context from a different place and a different set of experiences.
So it seems like once you go from doing to teaching, it forces you to like, to almost like map it out and like write down or codify what you're doing, which allows you to examine it more. And then therefore you then learn more about what you're doing.
Yes. So maybe while you're doing it.
Right. And what could be actually cool about that is, and this actually kind of also goes back to like when you build a standard operating procedure for your That's business, right. Like when you codify, you can create more distinctions. So you can say like, okay, I know at minute 52 on every interview, like this one thing happens, or during the intro, these four things happen, but then those four things are broken down into these three things and so on and so forth. So it seems like by doing, you kind of build your way of doing it, your system. By teaching, you're able to break that system down for somebody and explain it. By explaining it, you're making it more concrete in your own mind, and you're showing yourself and you're learning from yourself because you're then writing it down and teaching.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, so well said. I'm going to record that. No, but it's true. I think that in the process of learning also, you know, it causes you to research other methods. Maybe there were other methods that were out there that could have been that are effective interview techniques. And so doing, you might be like, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize there was this new technique because you research it. If you're teaching a class of people on it, you may not just research and break it down based on your own experiences, which is the starting point, but also based on others' experiences. So that's kind of the joy in some ways of teaching, is that you'll pull from different sources, codify that and break it down. And they say that actually, you know, true mastery is when you're able to teach a five-year-old child.
Wow. Well, five-year-olds are really smart. So that's not that hard, but I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
But what I mean, though, is you have to be simple.
Right.
So it's easy to teach in a complicated way.
Yes.
It's much harder to teach complicated topics in a simple way.
That's super tweetable. That's the tweetable line of the whole show right there.
I know. Like, should we repeat it? I forgot what I said. Well, I don't even know what I said.
I think it was something to the effect of teaching complicated things in a simple way.
Yes. Is actually much harder than teaching hard things in a hard way.
That is really, really cool. So earlier you mentioned how you came across your mission and your purpose like 10 years ago. How did that happen? What was that aha, eureka moment?
Well, mine was kind of a spiritual experience. So, I guess I, had this like spiritual awakening experience of questioning why I was doing what I was doing, and a challenge to really think differently about the next part of my life, and saying, you know, I had achieved the things that I thought were the best things to achieve, whether it's pedigree, whether it's prestige, whether it's money or whatever. And, you know, I have a really nice resume. So I built that nice resume thinking that that was kind of the BLL, you know, end all, and worked for great companies and, you know, and met amazing people, so, and you have nice cars and nice houses, and you think that that's kind of everything. And then you come to a point where you go, is that really like what life is all about? You know, is there any, is there more to life? And so I found myself asking that question, and then kind of had this spiritual transformation where I said, no, you know, from now on, for the rest, for this next season of my life, I'd like to really invest in the most valuable asset we have, which is humans. And I'd like to develop people and maximize human potential. So that has really become, in some ways, my life mantra. And my purpose in life is to humanize the world. And so I do that through my different companies and through my nonprofit activities. So whatever I do is kind of aligned to that mission.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So, I mean, were you just like driving your car one day and then, it just like hit you? Like, what was the actual event? What actually happened that day?
Okay. Well, I'm a Christian, and I was at church one day on November 26, 2008. So I remember it very specifically. I was just having like a moment of prayer by myself. And then I kind of had this feeling that God was talking to me. And it sounds a bit crazy, but it was just like this voice that I had never heard before. And this feeling, it was like an overwhelming feeling. And then I struggled with that because I didn't really understand what it was. And I didn't understand the gravity of what that meant, because I was so comfortable living my life the way I'd lived it before. And so to have this like challenge of go develop people was like, what, why would I do that? You know, that's not going to make me a lot of money, or so I thought, you know. and up until that point, I was actually much more motivated by maximizing my, you know, financial.
Well, it looks like we're once again having technical difficulties. So for those of you who have stuck around from earlier, I will share with you the answer to the riddle. And just to recap, refresh your mind, the riddle was, if there's a triangular roof and a rooster lays an egg right in the middle, which way does the egg fall? And the answer, ladies and gentlemen, is that roosters don't lay eggs. Gotcha. For those of you who got it and who actually had that answer to that question before I said it, let me know and I will give you a gift. Let me know again if you had got the answer to that question already. So Young, welcome back. I just gave him the answer to the riddle from earlier. So totally, totally fun.
Great. I'm so bummed to have missed the riddle. Okay, I'll have to ask the riddle from you after, because I would love a free gift.
Sounds good. So the last thing we heard was you had like this challenge of developing people. It's like, why would I do that? Because before, I believe what you're going to say was, before you were maximizing financial and then you cut out.
Yeah. So I was basically maximizing my own potential and my own financial potential, just to be specific. And then this calling was to really maximize human potential, which was very others oriented. And it was not driven and motivated by, you know, just making tons of money. So it was quite a challenge, and I struggled with myself, and I really struggled with that kind of calling, if you will. And then finally said, okay, I'll try that. And, that was 10 years ago. And then as a result of that, and it was not an easy journey, right? A lot of ups and downs. Becoming an entrepreneur is really terrifying at times. It's very lonely. It's very difficult. You sacrifice a lot, actually. So I had a much more, I would say, even though I worked long hours, you know, at different companies, I had a much easier, I would say, journey when I was in corporate than becoming an entrepreneur. So entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart. You know, you really have to believe so much in what you're doing that you're willing to take all the no's and all the rejections that you get along the way. People thought I was crazy. And so I think you have to be a little bit crazy to be an entrepreneur.
I certainly am.
Yeah, absolutely. So when, and I'm sure you get this a lot, Ben, but people often will ask me, so I'm interested in being an entrepreneur. And I'll say, are you crazy? And 19 out of 20 people will say, no, of course not. And then I'll say, well, maybe you should reconsider this entrepreneurship journey. But then the one in 20 will look at me. And I remember this one young lady, she looked at me and I said, are you crazy? And I literally said it just like that. She looked at me, she goes, yes, I think I am. And then I was like, oh, okay. Cause I was so surprised that that's how she answered it. And I said, well, you might have a chance.
That's awesome.
Because she wasn't expecting me to say that. But she's crazy enough to believe that her idea, and I'm crazy enough to believe that my idea is going to transform the world and make it a better place. And that sounds so cliche, right? But I really, really believe that what I'm doing and what we're doing makes a difference in a positive way. And so that drives and motivates me because it's such a hard journey. And being a tech startup, there's so much pressure. There's so much news out there. You know, every little mistake or every big thing is just, there's just so much noise out there that you have to kind of get back to your purpose and go, why am I doing this? Why am I building this company? And how do I continue to do the right thing for the people who are going to benefit from my product or solution? And then kind of stick to that and not get kind of impacted, you know, by all the noise out there.
Two questions for you on what you were saying. The first is, you mentioned how when you were sitting in church that day, you felt a feeling. What exactly was that feeling?
It was actually more like a voice. Yeah. So it was more like this audible voice that I had never heard before. And it was so loud that I actually physically turned around to see who was speaking to me.
Wow.
And I have never, ever had that experience in my life, nor have I had it since. So, you know, I'm a very logical person. I worked for McKinsey. Like, I'm a very kind of give me the facts kind of person. So it was a pretty profound experience, right? That it's really hard to even describe.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's transformed my life. That's why I remember to the day, like to the hour, like where I was, exactly what I was doing. It's kind of like 9/11. Everyone knows exactly where they were. Right. For me, it's one of those moments. I know exactly where I was. I remember the exact conversation that I had, and my life has been transformed ever since.
Wow. So yeah. The second question is, after having gone through that journey and now you're here.
Yeah.
Has it been worth it?
100%. 100%. You know, knowing now what I know about how hard this journey is and what sacrifices I've had to make on multiple levels, the joy that I get from living this life by far outweighs any of the costs in terms of sacrifice. I think the joy that comes from purpose, from meaning, from doing impactful things, the joy of seeing someone on my team develop themselves, the joy of seeing a client that actually uses a platform and has their life transformed, the joy of seeing organizations be better, the joy of having these students from this random high school in Palo Alto who I've never seen before find us and be inspired to do stuff that's good for other people. That's just cool. That you cannot put a dollar figure to some of that stuff. And so in small or big ways, just the privilege, and I do say it's a privilege, to be able to live out my purpose with a group of people who share that same purpose is really something that is so wonderful, actually. And I don't think money can buy that.
That's amazing. Well, So Young, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing this time with me. I know you have a very busy schedule, so I'm very grateful for that. I do have one more question for you, then sure. We'll wrap it on up.
No, it's such a joy, Ben. I have to say, it's been such an enjoyable conversation with you. I rarely get to talk about kind of this stuff at this level, so because people are not usually as curious as you are. So thank you for doing that.
Well, the honor's been mine, truly. And I feel the same way. So last question for you.
Sure.
But what question should I be asking you that I just wouldn't think to ask?
Oh, wow. That's a hard one. Oh, what question? Maybe the question would be, what is, I guess, my hope for, you know, where I see this future going, given all this technology, given AI, given all the fear in the world about automation? Maybe that would be a good question.
And what would your answer be to that question?
I think my hope is that I think with the future of AI, with robotics, with technology, that there is a greater human consciousness around what it truly means to be human. And because I think humans still have ethics, morals, values, a soul, right? And a spirit, which machines do not have and are quite far off from having. And so I think the humans will still need to play a critical role in creating the robots and the AI. But it's up to us humans to design a moral compass into basically wires and bits that don't exist inherently. And so that would be my hope. My hope would be that mankind steps up and really spends time investing in who we are and who we want to be in the world and what our purpose and what our values are at a really authentic and real level, so that we are not passive and let things happen to us in a reactive way, but that we're proactively shaping our future and the future of humanity, because I think we have the power to do it. But we have too many people, like we said in the beginning of the conversation, who are passively going through without actually thinking. And that for me is, I guess, my biggest fear and my biggest hope, that we become that we're a humanity that's constantly thinking, challenging, and raising consciousness.
That's wonderful. And I couldn't agree more. And I really, really hope that we take that on and live that, because otherwise the future could be pretty scary. So,
and I'm an optimist. I'm a realistic optimist. As an entrepreneur, right, we have to be optimists, but I'm also realistic. So we definitely, it's not going to be it's not going to be easy. I think there's a lot of challenges, and a lot of things are actually like decked against us. And so you see more and more people getting into this passive, unthinking mode. And I think it's really dangerous. You see it happening all over social media. And I don't think there's anything wrong inherently with social media. It's just how people are using it without thinking. And I think that is actually the most terrifying thing. And so I think thanks to shows like yours, hopefully your viewers, and you're actually impacting people to think, to be more conscious. And I think that's actually really amazing.
And of course, platforms like yours. So I'm, on that note, Soyoung, I want to say thank you again, very, very much for coming on the show, for being awesome, for sharing your time. And I just want to thank you for the very meaningful discussion. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ben. This was super awesome. Totally unexpected in a really, really beautiful way.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. And to everybody who's watching and listening, thank y'all very, very much. I love y'all a lot. So thank y'all, and I will see everybody on the next episode. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.